All right, welcome back to the Heffinger Podcast. We got episode 3. It's myself, my dad, and my mom. We got
episode three.
Got the whole gang together. So we put out a poll earlier about what you guys want us to talk about the most, and work-life balance, balancing work and life, won out. So that's what we're going to talk about today, and maybe some other stuff too. We'll see what we get into.
Yeah, work-life balance is a big one. I mean, it's you know, when you got two careers going and you're busy and you have a family, it's not easy to always juggle things. So you have to really work at it.
Yeah, and I think too, there was like three distinct periods that we could talk about. There's when you guys were in residency, you guys were both in residency, and you had started your family, having kids. There was once you retired and
actually when we were working.
Yeah.
As jobs.
Well, yeah, working both your jobs. Yeah. That
was another phase.
Once you retired, and then you could talk about more so like nowadays, like further along. So I guess four periods. So want to jump back to right? You guys both talked about it a little bit in episode 1 and 2, but we could start there.
Yeah, for me, it's kind of like a blur. You know, at residency, I was so busy. There wasn't a lot of work-life balance for me. It was just work. And Cindy did all the rest.
Well, the balance was he worked, and I worked and took care of the kids.
Yeah, I know.
He worked a lot more than I did.
So, I mean, I wasn't around a lot, so there wasn't a lot of balance there. But that's where that was the hardest part, because, I mean, that's where divorces happen, right? I mean, if one guy's doing everything and somebody's doing everything else, it works somehow. I mean,
well, I think we
acknowledge each other's career. I mean,
we also knew going into it that I would be doing more.
Yeah.
We knew that going in, which is one reason why I picked pathology, because it didn't have like overnight call, like on a regular basis. We thought it would be a little bit easier, but I also loved it because I had already done my PhD in anatomy. Yeah. So it was kind of a natural transition.
I think the main thing was you have to make time whenever you can. I mean, we would, whenever we had a chance to do something together with the kids, we would do it. If I had a weekend off, right? We took the kids up to Tannock Falls, which is this really cool place in New York up by one of the Finger Lakes. And we would have our dog Coco, and we would take Kevin and Brian, have them in a backpack. And you'd walk about a mile up this riverbed, up these huge waterfalls, and the dog would go swimming in the lagoon. And remember, Brian would sit there screaming, "No, no, Coco, come back. You're going to," because he thought she was going to get lost under the waterfall. So we did a lot of stuff like that when we had time off. But then there's times where we didn't have time off, and then it was, you know, every man for himself almost, really.
Well, it was actually, you were on your own, and I was with the family.
I know.
Yeah.
I'm not arguing that.
No, I mean, I'm saying you just were at the hospital.
Right.
And it's funny how we would sometimes, on the holidays and stuff, I mean, forget trying to get a card and maybe coming home and giving your wife or husband a card, and it was more on his end. But me too, I was pretty busy, but forget that, and then having a nice little dinner for like Valentine's Day or something like that. We would watch fireworks from the roof of the hospital.
Or from the IC. The IC was like on the ninth floor, so we watched the fireworks up there.
Yeah, I didn't get in there. But we met one time in the cafeteria to have dinner for some special occasion, and it wasn't him that got paged away. It was me that got paged away, which never happened, but it was kind of funny. And I guess, you know, you just got to laugh at that kind of stuff. And we knew it was sort of temporary, even though it seemed like it was a lot.
Well, what makes it harder too is, you know, we were away from our families. Like, we grew up in the Toledo area and our whole family was here. So for us to move away 7 hours to Rochester, New York by ourselves was a big deal. And then, you know, guess where our vacations were? Every
vacation capital of the world,
Toledo, Ohio. So we would always come home on our vacations. We had like 3 weeks a year, 4 weeks. And every vacation, we'd come home to Toledo to spend with our family. So,
well, it's funny. We always, in the summer, we'd always go to Cedar Point.
Yeah.
And we liked to stay at the Breakers, and it had no elevator.
Yeah.
And I was pregnant, like, I don't know how many times.
Yeah.
And so we'd have to walk up and down the stairs. And I was like, oh, when I was pregnant with you, I was big because you were big. Yeah. And he teased and because Brian was laughing at me or something. Little Brian was like saying, "Mommy's so big." And Dad said, "Yeah, she's like a walrus." And Brian just rolled. He just thought it was so funny because all I had was just this ball up in front, you know.
Do you remember anything in Rochester, Kyle?
I don't remember anything.
No, too little.
Yeah, Cedar Point's an amusement park with lots of rides. It's in Sandusky. Yeah. It's a couple hours from Toledo. But yeah, we've been there.
A lot of times it's had the most roller coasters of any park in the world. And it has, through the years, has always had a roller coaster that's been the fastest or tallest. Yeah. So it's a big amusement park.
And it's very clean.
For people who are from like the Midwest or this area, a lot of people, Cedar Point is pretty massive. I think they just closed down the dragster the other year, though, didn't they?
They did, but then they're reopening it this year because something fell off it. But
yeah.
Kevin always was disappearing when he was little, and he disappeared when we were getting hot dogs one time at Cedar Point, and we just were scared to death. He was like three. We're looking all over for him, and he was behind the hot dog hut.
Yeah. My biggest memory of Kevin was in residency. I don't know what year I was in, but. You know, obviously when we get people all the time, kids that hit their heads and stuff. So Kevin was out front and he fell and hit his head on the concrete side, you know, the concrete sidewalk in front of our house. And he hit it really hard and he was crying. And then he started vomiting. And then I didn't want to be the guy who just rushes his kid off the emergency department, especially since I was a neurosurgery resident. So I thought we'd keep an eye on him, and it was kind of stupid, but you know, we watched him. He was still kind of sleepy that night, still vomiting. But I said, you know, let's keep an eye on him overnight. And he was still had a headache and didn't feel good in the morning. So then I finally took him in for a CAT scan. And thank God the CAT scan of his brain was normal. But you know, that's the kind of stuff, if you guys ever had your kid hit his head and they're vomiting and sleeping, you know, you can have a blood clot over your brain. So I really should have took him to the emergency department, got a CAT scan that night. And I did, but I should have. And that would be my advice if you ever have your kid hit their head and they act like that.
Good jumping point too. I know you've put a video out about it and you've done a like blog about it a while ago, but yeah. The mother's intuition, yep. That exact scenario. Yeah, if you want to talk about that.
Well, no, yeah. It's just a mother's intuition. It's true. I mean, it's a parent's intuition. So dads don't get defensive, but it's more so a mom. And there was a child that came to the emergency department, and the child had hit his head, was fine at first, and then became sleepy. I think it had one bout of vomiting. And I think, you know, the parents were talking about, you know, should we just keep an eye on him and just let him sleep overnight? And the mom said, I just really think we need to take him to the emergency department. So she brought him to the emergency department, did a CAT scan. He had a big blood clot over his brain, really needed emergency surgery. And I ended up doing it. And he did fine. And he went home in a day or two normal. But, you know, he may have died overnight because that was actively bleeding when I took him to surgery. And so it's just one of those things. If you have a gut feeling that you ought to do something with your child and take him to the emergency department, you should. Don't ever second guess yourself.
Yeah, better safe than sorry, especially when it's involving the head.
Yeah.
Never trust a family dog, even if they're the best dogs in the world. Yeah. That was another thing. We had the nicest lab in the whole entire world, but we always taught our children, no matter what, when the dog's eating, stay away from the dog. You're not down by the dog's dish or anything. And didn't you have a case?
I've had several cases when I was in residency. I had one even in practice, but you know, family dog's been a family dog forever, just like your family dog, and took an infant and bit its head, and it crushed the skull, and actually the teeth went into the brain, and so I had to take the child to surgery and repair the skull fractures, and child's lucky they're alive, but they, you know, the family obviously put the dog down, but it's kind of sad, you know, you just never know what an animal's going to do, and so never, with our kids and our new grandchild, Archie, I never let get their face next to the dog because you just never know how a dog's going to react.
Yeah. That was a golden retriever, too. They're supposed to be such nice dogs, which they are. But it was just a case of always be careful.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, to give you – people are probably going, well, they're talking about all this other stuff, but what about the work-life balance? I think from my perspective, I think it has to be give and take with work-life balance. And there's always going to be one person who at times is going to get away with more and, you know – get out of some responsibilities. And, you know, we were always good about that. Like we get in our fights here and there because, you know, she'd be mad. She said, you're never around. I'm taking care of the kids. And that's going to happen. And you have to just come to some type of agreement ahead of time. We kind of came to agreement, didn't we, a little bit?
Oh, we had an agreement.
Yeah. Well, we knew,
but it's kind of funny. It was all good until, cause they're all, my kids were,
it's all fun and games.
I guess it was easy. You guys were good. You slept well. You guys got up really early with that kind of work with the schedule, 5 o'clock, 5 a.m. The boys got up. But when we had Christy, it was a little bit of a game changer. And I remember, you know, how you hear stories of like the wife is at home all day, and, or it could be the husband, but more often the wife, and she hands off the baby to the dad when the dad comes home, 'cause she's, you know, she needs a break. One time Christy had a lot of issues with reflux, and she had allergies and stuff, and allergies to the formula. So she had a lot of problems. And he came home one night, and I was literally thinking that I had either that I was going crazy, basically, because I was so sleep deprived. And I just handed him to her to him so I could go take a little rest. And I laid down, and I think I got about 30 minutes in, and she just screamed, and she would just pull your hair and climb up your shoulder. And you came upstairs and you go, "Cindy, I can't." 'Cause we had the other three little kids too.
Yeah.
And it was dinner time. And he said, "Cindy, I just,
but sometimes can't. They want their mom, but there are plenty of times where I say, I remember walking our little tiny dining room with Brian in the middle of the night while you were sleeping, and he would be crying. We took our turns as much as we could.
Kevin had night terrors. Do you remember that when I was pregnant with Julie, and I was so big because they were only 15 months apart, and he would just scream. And he was a little young for night terrors, but the doctor said it sounded like what he had. And he didn't want to be rocked. He didn't want to be walked. He wanted to lay in bed with us. So we'd have him in bed with us while I was pregnant in our full size bed.
Yeah. Now instead of kids, we have all the dogs in bed.
But I think what's important based on like when you guys talk about it is, communication is critical. Key. Yeah. Key. And just like acknowledging each other as equals, and like you said, give and take with each other. So having that open lines of communication, you know, sometimes he's going to be away at surgery all the time and be super busy, or even when he was more recently training for his Ironman, I bet you had to do a lot more probably with cooking. And
let's also talk about that.
But also real quick, I mean, there's going to be fights too. We fought a lot, I'm sure of it, that we would fight.
But
about.
I think that's probably what kept.
Yeah. You have to get it out. 'Cause if you hold it in, I mean, we would fight, you know, and this is.
'Cause I wasn't a rollover, and I expressed my opinion.
And well, and I didn't take it either. So we had some good, but I, you know, it works out. I mean, we're still married 30 years later. So
that's another thing. Yeah. You have to work on things. No relationship's perfect, right? And nothing's ever going to be perfect. So it's good to discuss things, put it out there, and work on it rather than like holding it in and feeling resentful.
Oh, if you don't discuss things and tell, like one of my best friends, I said once after I'd moved back, I said, "What happens when you and your husband argue, you know?" And she said, "We don't argue." And guess what?
What?
A few years later, they were divorced. Yeah. So I mean, I think that even though sometimes we argue and it sounds like a knockdown, drag down, I mean, I think that's partially what keeps the relationship alive, because we discuss things. Because you have your argument when you're angry or whatnot, and then when you calm down, then you can calm down.
Well, an argument takes, I mean, I've been saying this since high school. I read a book called Thank You for Arguing, but arguing takes on a negative connotation in our language, but arguing's not per se bad. You know, it's debating points.
What's it called? Thank You for Arguing?
Yeah, Thank You for Arguing. We had to read that for
Kevin used several points out of that book on me, and I didn't know it until Julie, who was a year younger, said, "Mom, that's from our junior English book."
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just about persuasion and just talking with other people. It doesn't always, arguing does. You think of someone like puffy red face, like very angry, like arguing is not necessarily that. Yeah. I mean, you get to those points, that's not as productive as like arguing and bringing up solid points or like wanting to be heard about things. If, you know, you do need a little help, like, you know, I've been taking care of the kids the entire time. I'm overwhelmed. I need to take a nap.
And you know, like I'm not really sure. I think we knew that the other, like I knew he was, I knew he couldn't help. So I think that at that point in time, we hardly had time to discuss or argue or do anything really. And I knew going in, I was going to be taking care of the kids.
Yeah.
You know, if I had it to do all over again, I'd probably do it the same way, actually, because I wanted my career. And
plus we had good residencies. I mean, we became really close with our co-residents, both our programs. We had a lot of fun with our co-residents, and they're still friends of ours, and people were having families, and we'd get together with them, and I mean, that helps take the stress off. I mean, it, there's so much that goes into the relationship, more than just you and your spouse and your immediate family. It's about all the friends that you have and the things you do. And we go out at night and have fun. And
thank God.
Each other's house. Getting yeah. those friends. People like groups that you guys are both friends with and like, yeah. you're doing stuff with like socially.
And it's because you're all in a similar situation.
Yeah, you're all going through the same situation. Yeah, exactly.
You can kind of relate to each other. Because like we, it would be hard for us to have gone out with friends that were just working a job and because our hours
they can't
are
relate.
So,
yeah.
You know. And we wouldn't be available to do a lot of things because even our own families never, I don't think, fully grasped just how, you know, why do you got to go back in?
Well, there's no, you can't ever know what it's like unless you've been through something. Just like, you know, somebody in a family dies, you don't know what that's like until you've been through it. So it's hard to put yourself in other people's shoes, I think.
Yeah.
You can try to think about how it might be, but until you've been through it, you don't know. So,
well, I think
and everybody
time,
has their own unique experience.
One time one of your siblings was like something about call or something, and they like figured you could just do whatever you wanted because you're just on call. You're just sitting at home.
Yeah.
And I don't think they fully grasped the fact that he actually had to go into the hospital a lot of times.
Yeah.
And it's not even how often you do go into the hospital. It's the fact that you have to be prepared to go into the hospital anytime, even if you haven't gone in several days. You got to be prepared.
Well, I give examples too, like even since I've been older, just nowadays. Like, so if my dad's on call and we go to a movie, he's got to drive separately. Or if we're going other stuff, he can't be more than like 30 minutes away from a hospital.
For trauma call, not trauma. For everyday.
Yeah, yeah. But that's what I was talking about. Yeah. But just different things like that. There's all those extra things you have to be thinking of. When we used to, nowadays you might pass off call like for your normal call if we went to a movie. But when we were younger, if you went to a movie,
right.
His beeper would go off during the movie. Sometimes you have to go answer those. So there's so much extra stuff like that. And I think it's better now. There's like social media, like TikTok, Instagram. You show some of that and people can get that. Think about 40 years ago. You couldn't even like, there was no internet. There was no Netflix TV shows there's no Grey's Anatomy. There's no following medical influencers. So you can't, a lot of people did have no idea.
Well, because you were at the hospital too. You didn't have the luxury of going to a movie. You would sit at the hospital because you didn't have a pager, or even if you did have a pager, you had to take in-house call.
But don't you think too, it's like being content with your life? Like we were both very content. I enjoyed residency. And I mean, for instance, like when we were residents, God, it was so cool. Like the helicopter flying to the roof and we go up there and we'd be waiting for the helicopter to land. We'd be right there. Like you see on TV when the helicopter lands. And then we get the patient, help them get them off the helicopter, on the stretcher, take them down to the emergency department. And it was really exciting times, you know. And if you're happy at work and you're having fun, it helps at home, right? Don't you think? When you're more content. Like if you're unhappy, you're going to fight more.
If you hate your job, then you're going to take it out.
So we enjoyed what we were doing.
It was exciting because we had residency. Our residency program was so big. And I hate to say it to make sure that nobody would misinterpret it, but the amount of cases and the number of things that we saw were incredible. Like my program, soft tissue tumors, bone tumors, those are very rare, but we saw quite a few cases because we were a tertiary medical center and it was pretty cool, to be able to have a chance to see those in real time, not just read about it in a book.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. We had an interesting case together. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, I remember it. So it was a long time ago, and it was somebody who was cleaning their crossbow.
And
whatever, but came in the emergency department, and there was a big crossbow arrow in his forehead that went into his brain about that far, and it was just sticking out. And the guy was awake talking, but obviously couldn't leave it, so we had taken him to surgery. I was in on that surgery, and we had to cut the whole front skull off, you know, so we had to take his scalp and then reflect it way back and over his face, and then took a piece of his front skull off. And we sent the arrow, you know, the arrow has prongs in it, so we had to take the skull off, carefully take the arrow out of the brain, and then we sent that arrow with the skull around it too,
cut off at the end.
Yeah, so, yeah, and then so that was then that was sent to you, and
it
then
was
you
sent
did.
To pathology, and I just happened to be the resident that was on gross that day. And gross anatomy is when you take the specimen and you describe what it looks like with the naked eye. Mm-hmm. Microscopic anatomy is when you use microscope. So you get the specimen, you describe it, you measure it, you know. So it's kind of funny, and then those specimens are kept. For probably there's a certain amount of time that they're required to be kept, but I would imagine because it was probably a medical legal possibility, they would have kept that for a long time. Plus, it's a very unique teaching tool.
Yeah. And the person actually did fine. You know, we had to do mesh to cover his skull to make his skull nice contour again. And he actually did well.
And how cool is it when you're standing there grossing a specimen and you see your husband's name?
I remember the funniest time is Paul Maurer is the attending. He's a wonderful surgeon. All our surgeons were great at my program, but
and they were all really nice.
So I was like in my second or third year, and I had my magnifying loop glasses on, a headlight, and I was doing a brain biopsy, and Cindy walked in because she was going to get the specimen. When we did the biopsy, she came to get the specimen. And Dr. Maurer goes, "What do you think your husband, what do you say? Like, what do you think your husband over there?
Doesn't he look cute?"
Or doesn't it get you excited or something like that?
No, something silly, but it was funny because I was doing neuroanatomy and I went to pick up the specimen. And so funny in neuro, when they do a biopsy, you can't even see the tissue. It's so small. And
it's a tiny little needle you use.
Yeah, and it's
that's all you need.
It's very pale and it's sitting on a piece of white gauze. It's very difficult to even see it. But it was funny.
So we had to interact with residency. It was kind of cool.
Yeah. And like, I can remember going up for blood bank. We'd go up on the floor when I was doing my blood bank rotation. And one time somebody said, "Are you related to that neurosurgery resident, Dr. Hefflinger?" And I said, "Yeah."
We still get that.
Yeah.
All the time. Anytime. Gotten that so many times around Toledo. Just, is your dad Dr. Hefflinger? Or because Hefflinger is a pretty unique name. Or some people are like, "Is your dad Mike Hefflinger?"
Mike, yeah.
Mike, who's an orthopedic
surgeon.
Right,
so my first cousin is an orthopedic surgeon. He's about 10 years older than me. He retired. But
he had that big, huge mustache. It, yeah. So people would always, he's like, "The one with the mustache." And they're like, "Oh, no, that's not."
That's not my dad.
But
yeah, it was funny. And when I was doing that blood bank rotation, they said, the nurse said, "Oh, he's so nice." I would get that a lot. He's so nice.
Mm-hmm. You got to be nice to people.
Yeah.
You can tell
that.
I think.
So what's our next?
Well, stage? I think, I mean, one thing I was going to say is definitely to go back for a sec was the sense of purpose and kind of mission for what you're doing. I think in medicine, it's heavily there. That makes getting through things much easier.
Yeah. And knowing there's an end date.
Yeah. Helps. And you guys knew, residency, like this, it's easier when you know, like, we have to get through this. It's going to be really busy having those discussions and knowing there's a light at the end of the tunnel.
Yeah.
Like, it's not always.
I remember after the 7 years when I turned my pager, and it was so weird because that pager, you have the same pager during all of residency, and that pager would go off so often. It was so weird turning my pager. And
after all that time,
it was kind of like I'm giving away a child, it felt like. And then it was like weird, like I'm not going to be a resident anymore. It's just what a weird feeling to think you're going to go somewhere and be the attending and the surgeon and not have anybody else watching over you. You know, you're doing all by yourself.
Well, I remember going after I was done and I had Brian and I was either at McDonald's or the post office, both weird places, but you know, places you go. And I was like, I felt like, oh my gosh, what if somebody needs to get a hold of me?
Man.
That was the feeling. Oh, yeah. And then I was like, wait a minute. No, nobody needs me. Nobody needs me. But it just was really weird. And I remember like,
because you're so needed all those years.
And then going and doing errands and stuff and not wearing dressy clothes, because we used to dress up. And I always wore like dresses or nice pantsuits. And I just felt weird not being dressed up. I mean, I dress so much more casual now, but, and so does everybody. But back then we were a little bit dressier and it just felt really weird walking around and nobody knew that I felt like a nobody actually.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, hard. Was that not just feeling weird to give the pager back, but then the identity of like, it feels good almost just like as a kid growing up, like feeling needed.
Yeah.
Like you're kind of the it person there.
Well, I remember when I first, because I don't think I had a job. At one point, I didn't have a job. And I felt really odd. Mm-hmm. I didn't like the feeling of feeling like I was nobody, because that's how society is.
Yeah.
Somebody that stays at home does not have value like somebody who has an important job. And I'd wear my nice tailored dresses and I'd, you know, carry my briefcase. Like,
also, it's different now. Well, first of all, being a mother or being the primary caretaker is a huge responsibility.
It's the most important job.
That shows, like, even the neurosurgeon coming home can't always deal with the kids. So it's not an easy job. Second of all, is there's just that sometimes you need to be getting out of the house and stuff. Like, that's coming back around with remote work, is if you just, like, are at home all the time, you could go insane.
Can go insane. I don't know how people did it during COVID. Yeah. And, like, Julie at school, she's in this tiny little room that if the hallway door was shut, or if her roommate's door was shut, and it was in the winter, it's pitch black in there.
Mm-hmm. But think how our parents did it. I mean, my mom stayed home and had five kids.
My mom and your mom.
I mean, they just stayed.
Well, that's why they were all on Valium and they drank cocktails, I think. And I'm just not joking.
It's definitely a different era of a woman was expected to, or like a good wife was expected to be at home and just watch the kids, cook dinners.
Never complain.
Yeah, well, it's just
good.
Different...
Hand the husband the cocktail when he walked in. That was the 50s, probably. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, even what? When was women's suffrage was just a little over 100 years ago. So before that, women couldn't even vote in this country. So, I mean,
which is insane.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Well, so strides are made, continue to be made. Obviously, it's always way slower than it should be with how things are, because
back to like your age group, like Julie, she's sitting in that little cell. I don't know how big it was, 8x6 or something. And she's studying in there. You know, you couldn't go anywhere. Yeah. So you got to work out in your room. You get to go downstairs and eat in your kitchen or whatnot. But how does anybody think that's fun?
We're social creatures. Us humans, we've evolved. Like, you need to be in tribes to survive evolutionarily. And we need a social interaction. So yeah, COVID was definitely terrible for a lot of like things like that. Just being so isolated. It's just never the same. It's not the same interacting over Zoom compared to being in person with people. So,
you know, I would shut my office door once I worked, and I would, sit in and do my slides and everything. But I came out when I needed a break and I could interact with the secretaries, or I could talk to my other pathologists, or go into the lab and talk to the techs. And I thrived on that because I couldn't stand to be alone all the time. That's horrible.
Definitely.
Yeah.
So a little veer there, but so let's move on now from your guys' residency. And then you said once you guys were both working, actually, when you were finishing up residency, when you were just starting to work and you were the deputy medical director.
Yeah, I was a deputy medical examiner for a few years while he was finishing up.
And was that different compared to like when you were both in residency? Now you're actually like the deputy medical
director. That was pretty cool, yeah, because my hours were my own and I felt more in charge. And they were better hours, but I did do
could
a lot.
Could you leave? I don't remember. Could you leave if you needed to?
Yeah.
Like if the kids needed to go home.
Oh, yeah, because I had two partners, right? You know, well, they were my superiors, but they were two men, older men, and if I had any kind of emergency, I could have said, they were so flexible.
They were very understanding.
Oh, got very understanding.
Do you think it got better then from residency to when you were working?
That job. Deputy medical examiner with those two men.
Yeah.
They were wonderful. And like, you know, you set your own hours. Like one day I was on and whatever homicides or deaths or whatever came in that day, so if there were seven, I did them. But if there were a lot.
She's talking about autopsies. If seven people died or were in an accident, she would do those seven autopsies that day.
But if there were a lot, the other two guys would jump in and help out. But, and then the next day it would be the next guy's, Dr. Forbes or Dr. Smith, you know, and we just rotated every 3 days.
And aside here, how long do you think a typical autopsy takes?
Depends on the person. And the training
so
and the experience.
Explain what you mean by the person. I'm assuming you mean.
Well, when I was a person,
be very careful what you say.
No, me. I'm saying like, okay, it goes both ways. Why would I have to be careful?
Like me saying, why is one surgery harder than the other?
Right. Why my first autopsy as a resident.
Well, that's just a fact.
I know, but still.
As a resident, took like 7 or 8 hours. Okay. Because yeah. I was a resident and I had never done one before. And
the person was heavy set.
And the person was morbidly obese. I think they weighed either 400 or 600 pounds.
Yeah.
So I can remember my boss was out on the golf course, but I was with the autopsy assistant and he was very experienced, but like everything on an obese person, it's very fatty.
Yeah.
And, this person's like liver, instead of it weighing 2000 grams, it weighed 4,000 grams. Jeez. And it's very slippery because it's fatty. Mm-hmm. And I can remember, you know, lifting that liver up to put it into the scale to weigh it. It's really heavy.
Yeah, and you're not.
And it's slippery.
Wait, was that?
Right. And
wait, were you wearing gloves?
Yeah. Of course.
No, so, remember the guy in medical school?
Oh,
one of our professors, he would take these organs out of the formaldehyde with his bare hands and never wear gloves, and it was just disgusting.
Yeah, but he couldn't feel the gloves. And one of my attendings, when he did breast biopsies, looking for cancer, he would take his gloves off because that's the way he was 60-some years old. That's the way he felt. And he was
a major HIPAA violation.
Now it would be, but even back then they hadn't started doing the formaldehyde. They started, taking air. They'd have you wear a thing so you could see how much formaldehyde exposure you were getting. Yeah.
But no, times have changed. The HIPAA's definitely had to have changed like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And I stopped right before HIPAA really kicked in.
Yeah. So HIPAA wasn't even
HIPAA wasn't there when I actually retired.
Okay.
Isn't that funny? But so
HIPAA's like it's a regulatory body. Most of you probably know it's a regulatory body that sets standards for hospitals about what you need to do for patient safety and your own safety and wearing gloves and all safety precautions and so.
And confidentiality.
But it can be very
confidentiality.
I thought it was confidentiality.
Like you can't reveal.
Well, I'm
like,
thinking OSHA, my bad.
OSHA.
I was saying OSHA.
OSHA.
No, I was going to say,
HIPAA's
patient.
Confidentiality.
Yeah, confidentiality. Well, OSHA is definitely.
OSHA is the regulatory body.
Yeah. But yeah, HIPAA is just all about you can't reveal anything about, like even you with kids, once if they don't want, you have to say, hey, yes, my mom can know about my medic. Like you can be paying for someone's stuff at school and you can't even tell.
That's another thing.
They can't know your grades.
When Christy was at UT as a high school student and was taking college classes, that dual credit thing.
Yeah.
I tried to talk to one of her professors about something, and there's a law called FERPA.
Yeah.
That's the high school.
Oh, that. Oh,
and
two
so I thought, well, she was, she was 15, 16.
Yeah.
I think she was 15. So I figured, that didn't apply to her. She wasn't 18, right? Oh, no. Once they're in college, doesn't matter how old they are. So Daniel Liu, when he was 9 and went to college, had FERPA too. The student has to sign something to release it.
But HIPAA, like you remember when my dad was taken to the hospital, he was having a heart attack, and I called the emergency department doctor who I knew and knew me. And I said, is my dad there? And she says, I can't tell you. And I said, what's my dad? I mean, is he having a heart attack or what's happening?
I had taken him.
I can't give you any information. No, when he went to MCO, but.
Were in Rochester.
No, here in Toledo.
Oh.
But when I'm just saying they wouldn't, it's my dad and they know who I am and they recognize my voice. And she still said, I can't give you any information. So then I sped out of my car. I was on call, but I was going down the street. A cop stopped me. He's going to give me a ticket. I said, my dad's having a heart attack. I don't know what's going on. So he was nice enough to let me go, and I went to the hospital. But, boy, I had a few words with her when I got the emergency department. Because, it's my father, for God's sake.
Well, you're a doctor, so.
I know, but
no, I mean,
you
so
can
that
see
should
that
have superseded HIPAA's
HIPAA's very powerful.
Well, even
it's
my
way
dad.
More powerful.
Even my dad, when he had the – he had a mass in his chest. He ended up dying of metastatic lung cancer. And I was talking to one of the pathologists when they had taken the fluid off of his lung. And I said, was there cancer cells in it? And I already knew he had mass. So I knew he had to have cancer. And my coworker that I used to work with just a few years before would not discuss it with me. He said, I cannot talk to you about the results. And I was like, whoa. And I mean, same
deal.
It seems weird.
It's not on them. It's just because it's so the consequences are so steep of what they do with HIPAA. Like, even if a doctor online acknowledges that if someone posts online to your Google business that, hey, like, thanks, Dr. Heflinger, if you acknowledge that that person was your patient, even though they put it out there that they're your patient, you can, that's a HIPAA violation. Yeah. You can't reveal that you've done surgery on someone, because that's disclosing the gap.
If they do it first?
Doesn't matter.
No, I just said that they can say, hey, I'm Dr. Heflinger's patient, but you can't acknowledge it.
Oh, my goodness.
I can't acknowledge.
Yeah, you can't acknowledge anything.
I didn't know that.
That's why it's like a weird thing. And I mean, they're cracking down the whole online. You really can't give out any type of, you can't even, the inkling of a personalized advice. So
that's why social media, you have to be very, a little bit careful in what you do, especially as a doctor, because you have to be, you just can't reveal any patient information when you're giving these.
Yeah. And just showing what you're doing. Like some people, there was recently the surgeon who got her medical license taken away, right? She was live streaming.
Also live streaming, yeah.
Yeah. So like, that seems very silly, but you know what I'm saying? There are people who ask, like, can you take live videos of surgeries, or can you put videos up of surgeries? And there's reasons like that. You can't, that actually takes, I think there's a very big distinction between, like, if you're waiting for the surgery room to be ready and you're taking a video explaining something real quick and we edit that and post it later, which I do, versus trying, you can't really fully focus on surgery if you're trying to do videos and other stuff too.
You can't. I mean, I don't know. I don't know all the details of that. It just, you know, you don't, if you're in surgery, you're not going to be really, if you're actively doing surgery, you can't be doing a video, I guess.
Yeah.
You know,
but no, those are just things like how the times are like changing, like that's needs will be addressed over time more and more. I imagine in medicine with all these doctors who now are on social media and how that works out. So to be determined, but going back now to the work-life balance, what about, we've talked about residency. We talked about when you first started. What about when you were both working? We're a little older, maybe when I, like, more in grade school. The time I'm thinking about is probably, like, you know, like second grade to like fifth grade when I was that age. He was definitely working a lot long, like he was working some long hours.
I think it was the same to me. It felt like the same as residency in the beginning, because I was so busy and I was doing a lot of trauma call. And I think everything's new and you're stressed because, you know, I'm doing surgery by myself and you're not used to it. And you're just getting used to your, you know, being a surgeon on your own. So, I mean, I think Cindy understood that. So, I mean, again, it was, you know, she took care of the kids and I did my job. And maybe, I'm sure I helped out in the evening when I could and stuff. I mean, we always did that, but it still was it was lopsided. It's always been lopsided. It always will be lopsided. Right.
I ended up retiring. Right after Christy was born, I ended up retiring.
Because then we had four kids, and you figured
it. And then I tried to go back and do forensics.
But we didn't want the kids growing up with nannies either, right?
Right. Because
that's what it would have taken.
I definitely retired because I told you that the other time that I had this headache, and I just was always stressed. And I finally I just decided I had to quit. And it wasn't like I was quitting for a year, a day, or a couple weeks, or a couple years. I would never go back. I knew that, because you can't. There's no remedial programs.
Well, it's hard to take a 5-year break or 10-year break
from
in anything, but especially not.
Especially medicine. Especially pathology. Yeah. I will tell you that. Because even when you take a week's vacation, it takes you longer to look at slides than it did.
It's a skill set, you know.
It is.
You gotta keep up on your skill set if you're gonna be good at it.
And I think pathology, look at the slides. That's what you do every day, is you look at slides.
Well, I think some people, they're like
slide after slide after slide.
How good people in medicine are, or surgeons or pathologists, you have to think that person, since after undergrad, they've already been doing stuff. Really through medical school and then all of their residency and then all of their time like in the field, you are just drilling in, like knowing, like people are like wonder when who aren't in medicine, like how do you know all this stuff? Like you just kind of drill, that becomes your second nature. Like that right. becomes like who you are. So you understand all that stuff. You can pick up on stuff yeah. way faster. So if you stop that for 5-10 years or any extended period of time,
you're not going back. No,
yeah, you can't pick
no
it back
program,
up.
No group will hire you. They're not going to hire you. And if there was a remedial program, they might, but, what I ended up doing is going back into forensics after a few years after having her, they were going to start a residency program fellowship, and I was going to be the first one to go through it because, as I said, there was too long of a gap,
yeah.
and I couldn't take my boards. So you would have to redo a fellowship.
Yeah.
So it's amazing just the terminology. You lose it. You don't use it, you lose it.
It's
know?
Not like riding the bike. You can't just
jump back on.
Well, and with certification, yeah, like you just said, boards yeah. are. Do you want to explain boards to people?
Yeah, boards are just it's a specialized test that's really, really hard and complex, and over a couple of days, and different for every specialty. And for instance, there's subspecialty boards too, and it was at the point where for forensics, they're not going to allow you to do autopsies and testify in court without having board certification.
Well, boards are to test your competency, so they want to make sure you're competent in your field, your chosen yeah. field. So you have to pass boards to become board certified, which is your society that controls your profession and says that you're certified and competent.
It's like the bar for lawyers,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And you
yeah.
have to, it's like if there was a driver's test to get your license, but you have to keep proving, like you have to get CMEs every
yeah.
year so you can stay accredited, so people can trust, like, this person.
I mean, if you're not board, like some people that aren't board certified, hospitals won't hire them.
Well,
insurance companies won't give them insurance because they're not going to insure somebody that's not board certified. So it's a big deal.
Yeah.
It's the United States safety mechanism against letting certain people get, you know, do something in the hospital that shouldn't be doing
yeah.
stuff.
And they used
and
to
even then there's
that,
people
but...
who sneak through boards and still, you know, have
I think it'd
problems
be really
and,
hard now.
Well,
yeah, oh,
think
yeah.
about Dr. Death.
Death or Death.
Dr.
Yeah,
that's insanity.
Yeah.
If you guys, we won't dive super deep. Maybe we'll do an episode on that sometime.
Yeah.
Dr. Death, there's a, I think it,
Netflix?
It's on HBO or one of those ones, but it's with Alec Baldwin.
Yeah.
It's a recreation of it, but.
He was a neurosurgeon with a lot of bad outcomes and was able to keep practicing and moving from house to hospital until finally he got stopped by a few surgeons who recognized that he shouldn't be operating. But, you know, I think he was board certified, and it's amazing how he went from hospital to hospital and kept getting hired with all these bad outcomes. So, you know.
No, still, stuff like that can
still happen.
Board
certification doesn't mean that you're still.
Doesn't yeah, guarantee.
Doesn't guarantee.
It is one
he,
step.
Well, he's in jail now. I don't know.
Yeah,
he's for life, but yeah. He's
probably.
But
it's a Netflix series, I think. I couldn't watch. I started watching it, and it just upset me so bad. It literally upset me. I had to stop watching because then I go in the surgery the next day and thinking, oh my God, I mean, this guy did this and can I do this? And it's like, how does that happen? And it just was upsetting me. So I didn't even finish the series because it was too upsetting.
I watched it with my girlfriend because you were shot. And then I was you like, for you, it's just like so far, if you know what you're doing, and that's how this one guy who did surgery, who's the type of surgeon when you're going from the front? What's
the vascular surgeon.
The vascular surgeon who like did a procedure with him. Said this guy, I don't even think understands basic anatomy. He
yeah.
was doing stuff so wrong. So, like, how he got through all of his stuff, residency and everything.
Well, that's the key: is how did he get through residency? How did he get approved through his residency? And so, I'm sure his residency program had a lot of questions thrown at them about that. But
that's a very outlier case. But it's crazy because there's always still things, and that's even in the United States. Like, there's still stuff that happens
mm-hmm.
all across the country and world that
yeah.
we're so
yeah.
So what I was saying is, like, what about when we were, you know, younger, we were all in a lot of sports and stuff and, like, school plays and other things like that. What was it like? He's obviously working a lot and you running around to all that stuff. What was that?
Well, you know, when I did end up retiring, it was such a relief because if he – like, my schedule was my schedule. If I was to work till 5, I pretty much worked till 5.
Yeah.
Whereas – if he got done with surgery or one got canceled or the patient load was lighter, he might get out on a Friday afternoon at like 3 o'clock. So if there I am working till 5.
And
so
the
then
dogs.
You can see there our time together was not as great. So the nice thing about when I did decide to retire is if he got off and we wanted to go do something, I could just get, he could call me and say, hey, I'm going to get off in an hour, and I could gather everybody together and we could go do something.
And then which I gave us flexibility. And then I don't show up, and then she get mad at me. She said, I can never rely on you.
No, I always
But it
do.
Happens a lot, right? Because well, I say I'm going to be there, and then all of a sudden I'm not there.
In the very beginning, it was a little crazy, but then it got a little better after I retired. But I learned to add an hour on to any time that he told me that he would not be home at 4, he'd be home at 5.
Well, that's a good trick right there.
You learned
that instead of getting mad, if you just get used to it, to you, and you adapt, and you're like, okay, he means to be home at 4, but he always gets caught up with
stuff. It's kind of what I do with you.
Yeah.
When Cindy says she's going to be ready to go at 6, it's always 6:30 or 7. So you almost have to say, we have to leave at 5:30 because then we'll leave on time.
Well, and here's a funny thing.
You can't deny it.
I'm not going to, because I was going to say something. I was already thinking about it. I'm never on time, and he is on time. One time, one of Brian's coaches, he was in 7th or 8th grade, and you know who he is. He's so cute. He told Brian, tell your mom that practice is at 5:30 instead of 6. So that I would get him to practice.
No, this cat. Okay.
Because he did not like.
Wait, pumpkin. We have a guest. We have pumpkin. A surprise guest.
Pumpkin, get on now. On
video.
Yeah, so if you guys didn't hear, the dogs and cats did barge in through the door. So.
Yeah, well, I think Abe pushed the door open, not the dogs, and they all came through.
Abe's very three-legged cat.
They
like, he's very good.
They want to hang out, so sorry if they're
annoying.
In background noise.
But, he told Brian, and at first I was kind of mad, and then I was like, you know, that was actually quite creative. Because I was always late, so it got him there on time.
Yeah. But, what was I going to say?
So, yeah, I learned to add some time on, and then, you know, I don't know, it was a huge relief in a sense not to have to work anymore. Even though I hated being at home in certain respects, because I put a lot of time and effort.
You're a very intelligent woman. And again, like that, it's a two different senses of purpose, like raising your family versus when you're out there doing stuff and, you know, providing for society or helping other people and helping solve cases.
Exciting, but you know, I kind of, you know what you said the other day about when you're busy, you seem to get more done because, that's how it was because, you know, I'd have to have dinner ready by this time or, you know, whatever. And then I'd pick this one up or take that one to practice. And then I'd study with the other two or whatever. So it actually kept me, it was good for me because I have a little ADD to have a more regimented schedule.
Yeah.
So at the beginning of the semester, I would, you know, write down everything. I had a big calendar and all the different colors and everything.
Yeah. I might be botching this, but I believe it's Parkinson's law where the available time you get done with a task and the available amount of time you have. So say you have 4 hours to do something, you'll take the entire 4 hours to do that task. But if you only have an hour to do it, you'll get that task done in an hour. So I think it's the same with that. And I think like right now,
Bailey.
Training for an Ironman, I bet Dad was like this too when he trained for his Ironman. When you know you have to do that, those different workouts and they're there, like if you know you have a long bike ride on a Saturday, like a 4.5 hour bike ride on a Saturday or Sunday, you know you have to do that. You get everything else done during the week. You get all your stuff and you don't waste as much time. Like you can't sit on social media. You can't watch TV shows.
Here's a funny one.
Plus it's totally your mindset too. Like if you go out jogging and you don't know how far you're going to go, it's like you just can't wait till it's done. You're just thinking. But if you have your mind already set, I'm going to do 10 miles and I know I got to do it, it's much easier. I mean, you're prepared for it mentally.
So here's an example too of understanding and knowing what you got to get done. He had very little time left before his Ironman and he needed to get a long bike ride in. And we were moving Julie into Ohio State. And so we drove two cars, which was great because we had a lot of stuff. And your dad went off and south of Columbus.
Did a 112-mile bike ride.
While I moved Julie in and we went to Target or whatever and got all the stuff and had lunch. And then he joined us afterwards.
Well, when you – that's awesome, first of all. And then second of all, is when you plan something out and you put it down, that's the importance of planning your week or planning your days. Once you put it there, it's way harder to like negotiate in your own mind. Like, oh, do I really have to do that? If you just say, I'm going to go bike today, and you know, you haven't set an exact goal of what you're going to do, it's easy to say, well, I'm not feeling as good later. I'm too busy today. I'm doing this. Yeah. It's way easier to make excuses with yourself.
That's true. So that's the importance of writing it, scheduling it. Schedule your workouts.
And just, I mean, schedule meal important.
Planning, everything.
Schedule the important things in your life. If you don't, if you don't schedule to like have coffee with a friend or schedule to do this and that, as you get busy in life, you just
all that. Do it.
Yeah, you don't. If you don't schedule things or prioritize them, they all fall to the wayside. But do you guys have anything else you want to say on work-life balance or just to wrap up?
Well, that was in the earlier days and then while you guys were in high school. And then you talk about work-life balance. There were a couple changes. First of all, when you guys all left, that was really weird.
Wasn't it? You were gone for 3 months when they were gone.
Well, it was a very short, long thing. But I'm the one that always stayed up with the kids or for the kids. And that was very stressful after Brian died, having to, for everybody, not just me, for them to have to negotiate high school and everything after having a brother die of a drunk driving accident. And I would just be so stressed out. But he had to sleep and you know, take call and do all that. And then all of a sudden, there was nothing. There was no sports. There was no kids. There was nothing. And it was weird for a little bit.
Yeah.
I started cooking for the dogs instead of the kids. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
We'd go out to dinner sometimes. And then I would go to bed really early like you do. And then I'd be up at like 1 o'clock in the morning because I'm not used to.
Well, you've always been. You definitely like – he's very much a morning person. I think even when we're on vacation, he wakes up early. You naturally will stay up later. I think you're more of a night.
I used to be a night owl.
I enjoy, like, you get a lot done in the morning. And I'm more like you. I can do that, and I like it. But I can just naturally stay up later.
Yeah, and I love, like, reading at night or watching TV at night. I used to read all the time at night.
I used to stay, when I was in high school, I would stay up and watch Johnny Carson. I remember when I worked at the gas station, I'd close the gas station, get home around 11:30.
That's 40 years ago, big dog.
I know. I'd stay up till 1:30 or 2 and I'd watch TV and I'd make my grilled cheese sandwich at home. But, you know, you get into residency and I got to be in there at, you know, 4:30 in the morning, 4 o'clock every day.
But even in med school, you learn to study. You like to get up early.
We would study late sometimes. We would stay late. But I do. Because everything's clear in the morning. Like in the morning, your mind's clear. I could absorb stuff.
Well, that's different.
You are definitely a morning person. Because at nighttime, I can't
remember anything at nighttime. But in the morning, I could absorb everything. It would stay in my mind. In the afternoon, it's like it's gone.
Well, that's people who for some people, like they feel circadian. They feel clear minded at night like that.
Yeah, you and I are night owls.
Like some people, if you stay up, you're like 2 or 3 a.m. Some people are like that wired for that. And if you look through history, You can see examples of both all the time of like how different people, really famous writers, like F. Scott Fitzgerald would go out and party and then he'd come home and write. Oh. And versus other writers would write early in the morning. And other people, they get, I've heard on like Joe Rogan before, he'll talk, he writes his best jokes like at night sometimes. Deep into the night.
I mean, I wake up all the time. That's my best ideas for everything come in the middle of the night.
No.
That's been my whole life. If you wake up in the middle of the night, haven't you ever done that? You wake up and you got these ideas. You won't ever know.
You got to write it down.
But I don't remember you ever getting up in the middle of the night when we were younger, before Brian died.
Yeah, I would. In bed, I would wake up and I would have ideas for things.
But you just weren't as inspired to write them down. And then just like you don't write your dreams down right away, how quickly do we forget our dreams? So, I mean, there's 100% science behind that. There's so many people that talk about it. Thomas Edison had this like contraption. He would fall asleep and have like a notebook.
And he'd
have something that wakes him up. So like once he fell asleep, he would have like all those brilliant ideas. Mm-hmm. It's pretty, if you guys haven't heard of that, you should look. It's pretty nerdy, but it's a fact. Because we have so many of our brightest ideas right out of sleep. Which is crazy, but we don't. Mm-hmm. It's hard to capture that.
Yeah, it is.
Because you don't want to take the time to write them down.
Yeah,
and then you kick yourself in the morning. Yeah, you think you'll remember. In the morning, you don't remember. You go, damn, I should have written it down.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's true.
I mean, something we could all work on, just capturing right after, in the middle of the night or first when you wake up, like anything you remember. I swear I have, sometimes I'll have dreams and I'm like, that could be like a, that could be a novel.
Yeah. You know, what's really weird is I used to dream a lot and very vivid dreams. Mm-hmm. And I would have dreams where somebody was trying to kill me or chase me or whatever.
Sigmund Freud
know, but I don't have dreams anymore that I remember. I don't.
You're probably still.
It runs a streak. So I, last four nights I've had dreams, which I haven't had dreams in hardly years. And all of a sudden I've had dreams.
You don't dream as much when you get older? That's an interesting.
I think, but again, you're probably still going through REM and everything.
But you just don't remember.
You're just not remembering. Yeah. You have to, like, remember when we were doing the gym quick thing? Like, if you really train yourself to, like, think about, okay, I'm going to sleep right now. I'm going and like have a nighttime routine. And then right when you wake up in the morning, write out everything. At first, I don't feel like I'll dream. But once I start to, if I do that for like a week, I'll start noticing dreams a lot more.
Really?
Cause I mean, I think most people are having REM. I know there's things like if you smoke marijuana or weed or whatever, you stop having as much REM sleep.
Really?
Or that's like a thing. People who smoke weed, like, will say they, or there's studies on that. They don't.
So have then REM sleep. That sounds like they don't sleep as good.
No, I mean,
isn't REM sleep good for you?
REM's good for you. I think that's where you're most creative, right? But the most important part is deep sleep, right? That's where you're releasing HGH.
Which one's four?
I think that's deep sleep.
That's night terrors. But yeah, deep sleep is where you're consolidating memories and things like that, I believe.
Well, that would be something.
REM is where you just your brain's very active during REM. It's like being awake, but you're still asleep in a REM.
Yeah.
Which one's the one you can't move? You're paralyzed.
That's REM.
That's REM, right? When you're coming out of REM and going into REM.
Well, REM, your body like paralyzes itself, so you don't carry out your dreams.
So dogs, they don't have, they're not paralyzed during REM. So when our dogs are, you know, they're making the noises in bed and they're moving, it's because they're in REM. They're probably chasing a squirrel or something, but they're still moving.
Yeah. Well, and I will say, none of us are sleep or dream experts, so
yeah, nope.
Take everything. We have to look at that some more. But because I just know from training, like deep sleep when you're releasing like the HGH,
maybe Donald Trump
is very important. But okay, we touched on a lot of things tonight in this episode, but. Hopefully, you guys got some from the work-life balance, and
it's kind of funny because we definitely now I think we're switching back now. He's doing trauma call again and stuff. He was a little less busy, and then COVID when he was completely off. Yeah. Usually, we don't like your dad to be off of work because he needs to be busy.
He's very antsy.
Very antsy. He needs to be busy. He needs to be doing something, but. He helps out. He's always been one that'll clean up after I make dinner.
I'm the perfect husband.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's it.
I do always help with dishes. Always have.
Yeah, and like he'll get groceries.
But I hate like Thanksgiving because then I get stuck. Everybody's eating and nobody helps.
No, I know that. I know that feeling.
No, I know. Well, you cook. You spend all the time cooking dinner and stuff, and then I end up cleaning all
up.
You end
up cleaning
it. And us two do it all. Although as they've gotten older, they've helped out a little bit more.
But like you'll call sometimes and say, hey, any dinner plans? I'm going to stop at the grocery store. Do you want me to pick up anything?
Which is all same. It's just give and take,
and that's so important.
It's very important.
Yep.
So I think for our next podcast, should we just touch upon nothing else? Do you want to keep going or just stop?
Or no?
Save it for another podcast.
Oh, I was saying. I think that's good for this episode. What did you want to talk about next episode?
No. We had polled everybody. We could do another poll and see what people want us to talk about. The second biggest thing that people want us to talk about was about grief and how to deal with it since our son died. And that would be an interesting podcast because you're in your own world. Like when Brian died, I think we all wanted to die, but we're all in our own world. Like I remember I couldn't think about you. All I could think about is you're just in your own, you couldn't, it's like you were alone. Like you were just alone on your own.
Very lonely.
And then trying to get back into work and your routine was very hard. And I'm sure we all have our own different perspective on how it
I think
went
kids, up, but, yeah. I think young people have an amazing ability to go forward and not deal with it. I think you guys as teenagers were able to kind of a lot more somehow because you dealt with it a little more later. I don't know if that's
But true. Having lived through, I think we could give people some idea what, you know, what it's like and maybe how to handle grief a little bit better. I mean, everybody handles it on their own, so there's not a rote way to handle grief, but we could, I think, give some tips to people that might make some sense to you.
Well,
if you're
I think
going
just
through grief right now.
Sharing our experience, I think, because this compared to the amount of things that are discussed about lots of other topics, I don't think people talk about grief.
Because it's uncomfortable,
yeah,
right?
It's uncomfortable. So I think that and then just like what's worked for us, what doesn't work. I think that'll be our, we can do that episode next. And as always, you know, we read everything, you know, the feedback. Let us know what you guys think. If you have topic suggestions, things you'd really want us to discuss, what you think of these podcast episodes so far, if you've listened or watched them.
Yeah.
And
if they're moving too slow, let us know.
Or yeah.
Or the dogs are distracting.
Yeah, we're sorry about it. We tried to keep the dogs out this time, but
they like to
be in here. They broke in.
Yep.
So hopefully that wasn't distracting. And if you enjoyed this, please give us a rating, you know, give us a rating on Spotify or Apple and our review just and let us know. That definitely helps as we do these. So,
and then I think, yeah, you know, eventually we're going to like, we'll probably talk as a family a little bit more. And then I think eventually we talk about having some fun, different guests on that you guys would be interested. Just maybe people that you wouldn't meet offhand that we know that we could have come on and tell some cool stories and be interesting.
Yeah, just kind of get, just have interesting conversations with different people we know and just kind of progress from there. And just go back and forth between either we do some episodes and have guests on, and maybe we can different guests we've met through social media too.
So we're trying to get Christy on. She could talk about being a new mother with a new baby.
As a
probably a lot of moms out there who are just getting ready to have a baby or have a young child. And how do they handle it?
Well,
how does she handle it?
Especially as a 21-year-old girl.
Yeah.
I think that was everything. And there's so much, I don't know, it's critiquing, criticism, advice. I mean, nobody was sitting around on the internet telling me what to do. It's helpful to be able to get information, but then everything you do now is there's 50 people giving you advice about it.
Well, there's not one right way to do stuff. That's the issue.
Yeah.
So,
and I think it'd be cool to have Julie on. So Julie's our third. She's in London now, but this is our quiet, shy daughter who went off to London on her own. And I think it'd be cool to talk to her about how did she get the gumption and the courage to go overseas, move away from us, because she was pretty shy.
Oh, she still
and she's,
is.
I mean, but tremendous how she's gone over there and done that. And
she's loving it.
And she's loving it. And so it would be good, you know, if people are thinking about, should I take a trip or do something different? I mean, Julie would be a good one to give you some advice what it's like to go out of your comfort zone, you know?
Yeah. And how long does it take to start feeling comfortable? Because it definitely took a little bit of time. And she's planning on staying for at least another year, so... Mm-hmm.
And she could talk about a lot more stuff too, neuroscience and other stuff. So she'd be good too.
Her and dad would be good to talk together since they speak the brain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So lots to come, but that's a wrap on this one. Thanks everyone for watching and listening, and hope you have a great day.
Thank you.
All right, night.